When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This season, we've asked our socios to choose their favorite interview from our archive. The big interview started in April 2015, and we've now done over 200 episodes to 8 million listens. Here's one of our socios explaining why the archive interview you're about to hear is their personal favourite.
Hi, Graham, Neil, and the team at Backpage. It's Taylor here from Shenzhen, China, and I've picked Damien Duff as my favourite episode. I really liked his story about how he still goes down and rents a five-a-side pitch and just goes and plays. I think that's an underestimated side of the game and shows his real personality. And I really like the passion and enthusiasm of which he talks about football. So, yeah, I'm really hoping to hear that one again. Thank you.
Damien Duff, we're in a hallowed place where you have made many wish, Lansdowne Road. Tell me how you learned your skills and when you knew that the ball was your friend, and how did you develop that?
For me, it was just, I guess, repetition, errors, practice, really. Like everyone, there's big talking points in Ireland now that there's not players coming through and it's down to coaching and what have you. But I got to Blackburn Rovers, who were then league champions at the time when I was 16. Not because of coaching or anyone teaching me anything. It was literally, like you just said there, just kicking the ball on the street against the wall, not even with people. So there'd be probably a billion old mates even sometimes. But listen, every day, just 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hours, just repetition, dribbling the ball around the street. It sounds probably incredibly boring, but I wouldn't change for anything. Like you said, I think you're in love with the game. I think I can match it. I'm just so passionate about it. I just love kicking football, as far back as I can remember, as soon as I could walk, and nothing's changed now. I'm recently retired 2-3 months, but for instance, last week I felt a bit of a weirdo doing it. I went down to the local Astro Park for a little five-a-side, but I went and I booked it on my own, just bored one morning, and just went to the Astro pitch and just had a kick about on my own. And that's 36, but still trying to improve my right foot, and I don't know what trying to improve for. I'm obviously retired, but just love of the game, just pure love.
And that need to, I've asked people in interviews across my life, now that you're not a player, do you need to be near a ball, something like that? Because they needed maybe the competition, or they loved the wages, or they loved lifting trophies, but some of them are like, I need to be on the ball every now and every couple of days?
Well, our mutual friend Mendieta, I was obviously with him last week, and I said, do you not just miss kicking the football every day? And he goes, well, maybe at the start, but as time goes by, he's not too bad with it now. But I said, I'm obviously recently retired and I just need to be kicking a ball. And I said, it probably doesn't sound very exciting to people, but yeah, I'll go out the back garden, kick the ball against the wall for 10 minutes, just get a little, my dose of it, and then probably back into the kids.
I don't know if I should call it cheating. Maybe it's professionalism, preparing for an interview.
Okay.
But I spoke to Tim Sherwood this morning.
And, he used to clean his boots. He made my life hell.
You see, the reason I sort of said this in this way is that I wondered if the two of you would have different memories of that time.
Okay.
He said, apart from David's evident ability, he felt that there was a stage when you were homesick and your folks came over, and Kenny Dalglish told him to go and have a long chat with your parents about, listen, this guy's a gem, he has to stay. What Tim remembered was, he said, apart from his ability, the fact that he was an absolutely fantastic kid, really nice, well brought up, good background, good family, made it all worthwhile. And he said, in almost every training session, he got lumps kicked out of him. I can't actually use the phrase that he used about it. And he made it sound like, retrospectively, that kid's life was hell. And he said, he'd go past you. He definitely made me look stupid in training quite a lot. He'd get a kick and he'd be right back up again. He said, a bit homesick, slightly timid then, but hard as nails. He said, hard as nails. We all knew that if we let him get the ball, he'd make a fool out of us. You're 16, it's Blackburn, you're away from home. How did you cope with that, and what's it like, and what did it do for you, retrospectively, looking back?
Probably when people hear hard as nails, they picture, I guess, people going around kicking people and what have you, but I guess what Tim means about me, yeah, I wouldn't say boo to a goose. I probably didn't speak for the first year or two there, but nothing was going to stop me. I said, Tim, yeah, jokingly, did make my life hell. I used to clean his boots for 2 years, and if he got polish on his hands when he was putting on in the morning, he'd just call me in front of the whole club, really, and just abuse me in the canteen, what have you. But it's just character building. That's what football is. Like, nowadays, he'd probably get done for bullying for that. Whereas I was probably a bit soft, whatever, but I still wouldn't change it.
There'd have been a time then when you'd have prayed to God for a big boulder to fall on his head so you could have a decent quiet day or two, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know, listen, he made my life hell, but it was always with a smile and a grin, you know. And the fact that, listen, he was the captain of the Premiership winning team, and he knew my name, and he was always on at me. To me, in a way, kind of made me think that he thought something of me. Yeah, nowadays he'd probably get done for bullying. So it's even Billy McKinley, I guess you know him well.
I know Billy.
If you think Tim was bad, he's a strong character. And I later obviously had him at Fulham, but he's the same. Literally just get abused every day. We all would, not just me. I said I wouldn't change it. Yeah, Kenny, King Kenny, God, call him what you want. It was a family club, amazing club. It's sad to see where they are now.
Oh, yeah. Did you initially live on a residence in a training ground?
Yeah, we lived at the training ground. Yeah, and it was only a year later I got homesick and I wanted to go home. And to be fair to Kenny and Tony Parks, Ray Harf, they wouldn't let me go home. Yeah. I was like, but I need to go home. I need to go home to my mum and dad. But they thought if I went home, I'd never come back. Amazing by them. They brought my mum and dad over for a week. And, you know, what kids are like with their mum and dads. After a day or two, I was like, oh, will you get out of there? You're doing me head in. Go back home to Ireland. And didn't look back after that. And I think I made my debut soon after, and you know, said I never looked back.
It was a strong gesture of faith by them, because you know, if you've got a youngster, it seems to me that there's always another kid coming through in football, and I know many lazy clubs that are going, well, if he's not... That's what I meant when we were talking earlier about short-sighted football. They're like, well, if he's homesick, well, it's not the right stuff, whereas they've gone, no, we're going to work at this. And yeah, that's certainly what Tim got through to me. He said that Kenny took him aside, said, work it, work. Mm. Help talk to the parents, spend time with them, see if that'll trickle down and whatever. And you talk about abuse, and you know, it made my jaw drop, because I was living and working in English football at a time when the class of 92 at Manchester United were coming through and were quite dominant. And it was only retrospectively when I read Gary Neville's book, Red, which is very, very good.
Yeah.
And it was the stuff about people being put in tumble dryers and burned,
well, like
soaked.
Crazy stuff.
I mean, I wouldn't consider myself soft, and I'd have been very sort of chippy about that, and it might have broken me, and I might have gone, oh, whatever, but that's quite...
Yeah.
Roots.
I like, yeah, even my friend that was on to him earlier, he actually never made a Kieran Ryan, but he lives just down the road from me now in Ireland, and we're married to sisters, and like, I remember they were called court cases, and most of the time you were found guilty, and like the stuff that used to happen to him, like it always seemed to be him for some reason, I don't know, but like he had to get in, like, you know, ice baths with no clothes on, and they'd pour cups of urine in on top of him. And I said, now you, I don't know, get arrested. You'd be something, yeah. You'd have to get into a sauna for 40 minutes with all his clothes. That's mad stuff. But I just look at his character building. But I said, now it's, I think generations are there just a bit softer now. I don't know.
The Blackburn experience goes well from one Scottish legend to another. Souness.
Yeah.
A game I watched that I'm interested to ask about in that, you know, I don't want to be mean, but I certainly wouldn't be the world's greatest admirer of Glenn Hoddle as a person. That's my own personal view. And I've never been a bigger Blackburn fan than the day you got to the final against
Spurs,
them.
Yeah.
I feel you're kind of viewed as slight underdogs. Is that fair? And it was kind of an expectation of Spurs are back, they've got God in charge, it's perfect harmony, it's all. And so he was still, even then, regarded as maybe a manager that, you know, a Marmite person, Marmite manager. We've got great regard for him. He did a brilliant interview with us. I like him a lot. I think he's a very different person than he is regarded because of some of his antics as a footballer. What was it like working with him? What was that, the build-up to that final? What were the memories of that?
Yeah, I remember it was like Glenn Hoddle gods. Well, that's what he's called down there, isn't it? And I guess I believed it as well. I was like, oh, Spurs, their name's written on the cup because so much was made of them going back there. But listen, Graeme Souness for me, I remember there was a lot of stories that he was getting rid of all the Irish Catholics out of the team, which was nonsense. Yeah. I think he did it at Liverpool as well. But like, he used to have fun with me the whole time. I think he split up from his first wife, didn't he? And his second wife is a Catholic, isn't she? And like, he was amazing with me. He really kind of probably kicked me on in my career. Yeah, I loved working with him. He used to join in. He was still a player. I love listening to him now. I can't speak highly enough of him.
He's a real football man for me. And I think as well, there's post-football, there's this culture of, I better not say what I feel about what I've just seen on TV, because in the future, that person might be useful to Mike. And he just says it exactly as it is, as he sees it. He's as accurate and fearless as a pundit as he was as a footballer. Yeah, well, and he was a special footballer too.
Right? Yeah, he was amazing. And obviously, there's not many Rangers fans in Ireland. But I'm obviously recently retired and trying to figure out what I want to do, whether it be coaching. And I always hated punditry and hate pundits, maybe because they were giving me stick or whatever. But I tried it last week on RTE here for a Champions League game.
Oh, seriously?
Obviously, before, the producer's like, who do you admire? Who's your number one man? And straight away, it's Sui. And like you said, he pulls no punches. Yeah. He'll happily get into an argument on TV and just says it how it is. And I can't speak highly enough of him.
How was the training thing? Because one of the famous things about Fergie was, who maybe came to fame at my club, Aberdeen, and then at United, employed a series of coaches so that increasingly, largely throughout his career, Fergie wouldn't train. He would watch, he would observe, he'd actually hand a lot of authority, devolve a lot of authority to people who are exquisite coaches, because the idea of a coach and a manager, they must blend, but they're also separate, they're parallel. What was Graham like as a leader at Blackburn? Was he the coach? Was he the manager who worked for him in those days?
I'd go with manager, I guess we probably wouldn't have done an awful lot of coaching. He's probably from the old school Liverpool way. He's probably like King Kenny was, just warm up, little boxes, bit of fun and a five-a-side. That's the way I remember it anyway, which is what all footballers love.
This is 3 years after York and Cole have won the treble, because we're talking about approximately 2002, I think.
Yeah.
And 99 they won the treble for United. And how was your relationship with them in terms of supply and...
We had a good coach now that I remember as well. Dean Saunders came in, like one of the funniest men in football, just incredible. But just one-on-one work with him, and obviously he was a striker and just trying to tell me what York and Cole would want. But the wavelength they were on was incredible. Like, their legs was probably gone a bit, and I think they were only 30, 31, were they? But the little overs, step overs, just on a different planet. So yeah, it was amazing playing with them. Obviously, not even the twilight of the career, probably just before, but... Yeah, it's amazing signs for Blackburn back then.
Does the final bring any memories for you at all? Or is it a blur? Because
the Spurs final?
Yeah.
I remember the roof was closed. I think I played, every two or three times I've played there at Millennium Stadium, the roof is closed. It's just like playing in a sauna. You can't breathe, and it's so much harder to play in. I remember I nearly scored. Neil Sullivan pulled off a great save. I've had a couple of chances in cup finals now, the League Cup finals. I never managed to put one away. It always kind of grates at me. Never had the pleasure of playing an FA Cup final. But I think that was February time. We were hovering around the bottom of the league and we just kicked on after that. Me personally as well. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, obviously. We obviously won the final. I remember being drunk for one or two days after that. And yeah, just it was lift off then. And we rocketed up the league.
Was that your first big trophy lift?
Yeah, yeah.
You signed for Chelsea and along comes Mourinho and you turn up at the Camp Nou. I had just moved there and I needed my freelance revenue and put the team that I was covering most out of the Champions League, and it was quite dramatic and you were quite central. Can we talk about those two games?
Yeah.
So, the way I remember that game is Barcelona, still very fledgling, Rijkaard are completely outplayed and out-strategised as well. So I don't know what the manager had said to you beforehand, but the way the game tilts, for those who didn't see it or maybe are younger, is that I think Carvalho puts a lovely ball down the right channel for you. You're away. You show Gio Van Bronckhorst not only clean heels but all your clean washing and centre it. And Belletti puts... It's your.
I was claiming that goal.
It's your goal. I was there. It's the first time I've ever nipped to anything quicker than you. Yeah. But it was your goal. Of course it was. And Belletti says that too. You're 1-0 up. And then somebody puts quite a dangerous ball in from the wing.
It was me, for Drogba to send him off.
For Drogba to flat out assault Victor Valdes. Now, I'm only being provocative. And he gets sent off and it's a big old row. And Jose Mourinho says at the end of the game, Frank Rijkaard went into the referee's room and whatever. How did you guys, as a team, as a group, build up to that game? What was it like approaching the Camp Nou for the first time?
First time, yeah.
And the tactics and the strategy and the idea. And at 1-0 up, what was the feeling? You know, this is the boss. Tell me the whole. Bring me inside it. Epic.
To be fair,
game.
I can't remember.
You know it's going to a very good part two for you. Eh? You know where it's going
to
end up.
To be fair, Mourinho wanted Barcelona. And we all thought, he's crazy. Like, we were flying back from, I think, Moscow. They were in a group. Maybe we just topped their group. And the lads were just having a bit of crack with him. We're like, who do you want in the second round? And he goes, Barcelona. And we were like, are you for real? Like, and he goes, no, simple. We stopped them playing and they let us play. And it was as simple as that. I remember leading up to the game then. I think we lost in the FA Cup to Newcastle a couple of days beforehand.
1-0 maybe?
Yeah.
Up there?
Yeah. I had a knock. I remember him telling me I was playing, but I remember him playing a few mind games with the press. He named a totally different team and he goes, I'm going to do this later. He pulled me aside, you are playing tomorrow, but I'm going to give them, I think he said Gudjonsson was playing ahead of me. So when he did name the team on the TV, I started believing then. I thought, maybe his idea is playing. So then I thought, why are you I'm not playing. So I kind of had to wait 24 hours for him to name the team, and yeah, lo and behold, I was in it. Yeah, for me, like every young child, you talk about teams in England, but to go and play in the new camp, like dreams come true stuff. And that was probably the start of the rivalry that I guess still goes on to...
It's quite epic. It's been theatrical. It's been so...
And it probably all started that night with the sending off, Frisk, the dressing room stuff, which like we didn't even know what went on. We were just reading it in the...
I'm not trying to drag you into that. But if I look at it now, like, because you always hope, he genuinely hope that there's three journalists in this room or communicators in this room. He genuinely hope that you call things accurately. And the first booking, I think, you know, it's one of those, maybe, or whatever. And one booking, it doesn't matter that much. Second booking, the ball, your point of view is more important than mine. But it looked to me as if the follow-through meant that in most times, you're going to get a yellow for that. I mean,
No.
You wouldn't be the first to tell me I'm wrong, so don't be slow.
I remember, was it two yellows or did he give him a straight red?
Two yellows.
I'm obviously biased, but I remember back in the day, we were like, how can you send them off? And to be fair, like I call it the dark arts of the game. Maybe other players don't know it so well, but it was a Valdes in goal.
Yeah, it was,
And he's rolling around like he was being shot. Like, I think you have to do it nowadays. I see Mourinho, if a player didn't do that, he'd have a go at him then. That's the way the game is gone. It's just a small detail. Yeah,
be streetwise.
Yeah, he's probably caught him a little bit, but then Victor Valdes has been streetwise.
You look back at it, and it's still quite a flawed Barcelona team. They haven't reached maturity. They haven't fiddled around with certain parts that need to. Maxi Lopez changes the game. That tells you something. Because Maxi was never really that much of a footballer.
Yeah.
And that was the end of it.
Yeah.
And so there's a bit of bad blood. And the first we hear of the Frisk thing is the media coming. Yeah. We'll go downstairs. And the press chief, I think, was Simon Greenberg at that city. He comes out, well, nobody from Chelsea will be talking. There's been an incident and we're in the huff and off we go home. Oh, well, fair enough. That's okay then. And then comes know if it was a week later or 2 weeks or whatever. So before we talk about goalkeepers again and Carvalho for the fourth goal, was that anger, those first sort of 30 minutes? Was it Barcelona's ineptitude? Was it better tactical planning by Mourinho? Because what was the adjective you'd reach for in that respect? A typhoon, a hurricane? You know, Barcelona were made for a chunk of time to look third division.
Yeah, what was it? 3 goals in 15-20 minutes, I think. Just going back to what he said earlier, we stopped them playing, which we probably didn't stop Ronaldinho that night. It was an incredible performance. I remember that second goal, the toe bog. I've never seen it before.
But it's not just that part.
The little shuffle, yeah, the little shuffle before. It's incredible, yeah. They're always showing it in Sky Sports, and listen, you can't help but watch that game when it's on. But yeah, it was just, we believed. What can I say? Yeah, Barcelona, they were a world-class team then, but they still weren't the patch in what they are now.
No.
No chance of that. Yeah, it was just us believing.
If I've got it right in my mind right, you know, the Damien Duff goal is a 3-0 goal. And I think there's, you know, a big transition from, I think it's Carvalho to Cole.
Yeah, Cole.
What a pass, eh?
Yeah, wait, I don't
Can
think I had to take a
moment,
touch.
Yeah, what Joe does, because Carvalho comes powering through, I think maybe nips off somebody's toes, yeah. And it's a volley pass.
It's incredible, yeah. I think it was up around his hip and he's just stroked it, like, beautiful, beautiful ball. I don't think I took a touch, to be fair. It was just so perfectly weighted. And I remember I probably didn't help proceedings on the night, running over. My mum and dad used to sit above the dugout. I was actually running over to them, but when you look back, it looks like I'm trying to dig Rijkaard out and the bench. Well, and I think it kicked off a bit in the sideline.
Take that.
Yeah, but I was actually just running over to my dad, you know. So,
Or at least that's the worst story will remain.
Yeah.
They were never there, were they?
He was there, all right. Yeah, he wouldn't miss that.
Is it just a waste of breath to talk? Was it planned that Ricky Carvalho would block off Valdez? And wait, who took that corner?
Me.
It's kind of your tie, isn't it? Between the first goal and the sending off and the, you know, the 3-0 goal and then the corner up there.
I remember the fourth goal was horrendous corner. I near enough hit the penalty spot and it was, JT didn't get his head and it was going outside the box. I remember the minute I hit it, I was like, oh my God.
I don't understand that because, okay, maybe you didn't need to, but JT's completely, he's on his, it's John Terry. Yeah. He's on his own.
Yeah.
And it's a massive leap. It's a beautiful header, however you describe the corner.
I made it a good ball. But again, Ricky Carvalho with the goalkeeper, it's just a dark arts, just streetwise, giving him a little nudge.
You're all right with that in general. I'm not talking on that instant. You're all right with that, the dark arts.
Yeah, well, back in the day, I probably wouldn't have been, but it's just, I guess, the education that I've had with Mourinho and what have you. Yeah, like when I'm coaching out of 15s or whatever and there's like young kids and I'm never telling the kid to dive, but like if someone clips their heels in the box, and I'm careful the way I do say it to them, but like you have to go down and get your penalty. There's no rewards for trying to stay on your feet, you know, and you stumble.
I've seen people miss goals because they've gone, and then they fall.
You're
going to get a lot of grief for that as well.
Yeah. Honesty doesn't get you very far in football. I think you need to have that streetwiseness, call it what you want, bordering on cheat. I don't know whether you can even call it cheat. I just think it's clever.
I think you can hone your instincts. He said, not playing with words deliberately, but I remember, albeit I'm not a fan of him, I'm self-aware enough to know that almost every good footballer who's coached by Glenn Hoddle said it was a good experience and that England lost maybe a tournament-winning manager there. Certainly somebody, and he told Michael Owen very early on, so you're fast and you can finish, but run across the last defender. But I think the rugby thing is run straight.
Yeah.
But in football, it's like, once you're away, just make sure that you, as long as your angle for the finish is okay,
get an effort. To cut them off,
And then, what happens? You know, the world stops in 1998 in Sinitian, I think, against Argentina, where he's run away and scored that brilliant goal, but he's also run away, got in front of the defender, and the whole bush, then you go penalty.
Yeah.
And that I think, is where the bridge between, like, honourable play and do it the right way, and then dark arts, maybe. If you put yourself in a situation where somebody's going to do something then and you feel a touch, then obviously you go down, eh?
Yeah.
It's good enough. Winning is winning. Leaving Chelsea was a mistake, eh?
Yeah, but I'm just a stubborn Irishman. Nothing's ever changed, really. Yeah, I do look back and I was like, just stay around and fight like you've always done for your place to make it, I guess. I don't know. I remember when I left the day, Jose just called me into the office. He goes, you know, if you're fit and playing well, you play my team every week. I was just, yeah, whatever, good luck, I'm out here. And it was just really because of the last 3 months of the previous season, I was in and out of the team. And to be fair, I wasn't at my sharpest. I remember having a few problems, calf, Achilles, what have you. And I wasn't even making the bench on some games on the run-in. And that hit me hard because I just loved playing football. And yeah, when I look back, I should have taken a step back and gone, yeah, get yourself right and get back in the team. But I was just so distraught. Listen, it's a short career, travelling away, going to the bridge, whatever, and just watching from the stands, that I didn't even look at Chelsea winning trophies, at winning or working with Jose Mourinho. I was just like, I need to go somewhere and play football. That's the way I looked at it, black and white. So yeah, mistake. But then I look at, no disrespect to him, like the likes of Mikel and what have you, like he's there 10 years, but I wouldn't say he's played an awful lot more games than me. I don't know, for being there 10 years, I'd rather go play and just enjoy.
The wages and the salary and the good life is a byproduct for you. It's good, it's healthy for your family, it's healthy for your future, but it is a byproduct to playing for you, isn't it?
Yeah, like I went to Newcastle, I said, there's obviously an awful lot of money in the game, but I went, took a pay cut, just wanted to play. Like I never get involved in negotiations with, just let my dad and advisor, whatever, go in, and I just hang around, just wait to sign up. I wouldn't even ask how much I'm on, like, and I'm not bullshitting you there when I say it. That's fact, it's just love of the game. Was it a mistake? Yeah. I went there and, God, I had a horrendous 3 years of my life. I give them everything. Like, the Geordies think I went for a jolly up, for money, for this, for that. I had a lot of injury problems when I did play, never really got any rhythm. And my God, like, that is character building up there. That will make you or break you. Like, 52,000 every fortnight. Just, like, I laugh about it now, but my God, just yeah, screaming how, oh, they used to hate me. Yeah.
If you can look back with that type of clarity, you must be aware that you could have probably flipped a coin and it could have gone exactly the opposite way, because everything about you, your composure, your love of the game, your skill, what you could do with a ball, if they'd taken to you, they'd have probably seceded from England, formed a kingdom, and you'd be on the throne, because you embody, as a person, a footballer, just about everything that they yearn for, which is kind of confusing. Yeah. Yeah. Given that it was a shit experience.
Well, listen, all the lads on the team, the local boys, Stephen Taylor, Stephen Harper, whatever, they used to tell them they love you or hate you, players up there. And yeah, I just didn't get off to a good start, and they just made their mind up and be really sharpish. Like, I still would not change it for the world, leaving Chelsea and going to Newcastle.
But I want to go back to that, change. Because I wasn't taking you up for leaving. You'll be aware that Josie's emphasised this recently by saying that side, you, and he names you, killer instinct. He said the Chelsea that he was sacked from, the Chelsea that he came back to, didn't kill games. And he said, you know, that's what we did, that's what Damien Duff did. And he talked about your attitude, he talked about your fearlessness, he talked about the fact that if you could get on a team and do a team and win. And that's him still talking about it all these years later. So all I meant was, it was no way derogatory about the decision to leave. I didn't know about that meeting, but when he said you'd be in my team, he meant it, and he still feels that way. And I think that's a major, major... You can't put it in the bank, praise. And I think maybe through your career, that's not been the thing you've sought most. But it's pretty sincere. It's pretty serious praise from him.
Yeah, I've said, for me...
I could put you in a situation you don't like.
No.
I just said it and then I've done
it. Listen, for stupid, me, I love the man. Like, yeah, in the end, I said, listen, good luck, I'm out of here. But listen, the best 2 years ever working, I'm just...
Was it fun on a daily basis?
Yeah, he's a funny guy, for starters. But, like, coaching, training sessions, unbelievable. Like, frightening. Improved everyone no end. Like, it was more or less the same squad he inherited from Ranieri. I think he had a couple of additions. Obviously, Drogba struggled, really, for the first year.
He wanted to go home.
But he just turned us into winners just straight away. That arrogance, that confidence, just rubbed off on everyone. And just, I said, steamrolled the league for a couple of years. And the thing, obviously, whether I want to go into coaching or managing... The fact him leaving Chelsea this year and looks like he's lost the dressing room, I just find that staggering. Just, there's no hope for any of us if he's losing the dressing room.
We're into an area where I need to be careful, because I didn't play for him. If the people who play tell me it correctly, then maybe there's been a change in the man, a change in him.
Yeah.
That, as phenomenal as he is, his human being, and I think in his attitude to playing and to life and to... And also the dark arts, sometimes if you wear the Lord of the Rings, if you wear the ring too long, it corrupts you. I think maybe some of those who encountered him when he came back to Stamford Bridge that second time found a change.
Mm.
So maybe we can put, or maybe I can put it down to the fact that it's not that, you know, something ridiculous has happened because Chelsea have lost a guy who's still the guy he was in 2004-5-6, is my interpretation. We all do that, we all change, for better or worse. And maybe it's going to give us all a treat where... maybe he's in control of one half of Manchester next season and then Guardiola's in charge of the other half, which...
Well, yeah, if I was a betting man, no doubt he has to end up there, especially after Guardiola's arrival going to City. I said the only statement Man United can make is him, and anyone else would be wrong for me. I said there's only one man for the job there, it's him.
Your faith in it. And one of the things you said there, I wonder if it's a thing that Mourinho has to maybe work a little bit on, is that I think that Ranieri deserves a great deal of credit for the side he...
Yeah.
You know, you said it in a way which wasn't really, but Ranieri built a hell of a side.
Yeah.
Now, my admiration for Mourinho, I'd like to respect him more, I'll be frank, I've said this before, I'd like to respect him more. I actually actively would like to feel more respect for him because I can see why he should get that. But a discussion that he had with Abramovich, because Abramovich became obsessed with Barcelona and obsessed with Ronaldinho, and he said, look, you know, when Jose came, I'll buy you Ronaldinho. I went, no, I don't want Ronaldinho, I want Drogba. Look at that bet.
Yeah.
Ronaldinho within a couple of years was burnt out and overweight and kind of has just puttered along since then, whereas Drogba went from, I don't want to be here, I want to be back in Marseille. I'm out, I'm like, oh, wins Abramovich, that most extraordinary European Cup final. That was a decision of Mourinho's, which was exceptional, but I've always felt that Ranieri was the guy who...
Well, he bought Robin, like no one really remembers that. He bought Arjen Robin, he bought Peter Cech.
Lampard.
Yeah, me, good, he bought the lot of us, really. So
the Czech deal was
done. Was the Robin one was done. Like, listen, amazing, great guy. When I see them Leicester this year, I find it staggering, just absolutely staggering. The one thing, like, they obviously haven't got quality of City or Spurs and all. They just will be giving him 200% because he's such a great guy, and they just love him to bits, just like we did. We all knew he was going that year at the end of the season. But
so it wasn't the Monte Carlo thing. It wasn't the Monaco night when.
No, I think he was gone. He was a dead man walking. If it was any other manager, you'd probably have lads down in tools and what have you. But we just love to get Ranieri so much that we just give him everything till the end.
Is it easy to explain that now, Rick? Can you say what it is about him?
I don't know. He just has such charm and charisma.
He's quite eccentric, isn't he?
Yeah. Like, I don't even want to go into the smaller detail, what training and all. Like, when Mourinho came in, training was just on a different planet.
Right.
Compared to what
higher level intensity,
everything. So whether Claudio would have won the league the way we were going with him, I doubt. I think he still needed Mourinho, definitely.
But so Claudio had an ability that somehow you click with your soldiers, and they give you more.
He definitely has that. But then, like, you have to ask questions. Like, he's had big squads all over: Monaco, Inter, Valencia, Chelsea. He's never won the league, I don't think. Am I wrong?
Thank you for putting me on the spot, because
I don't
think
did he
win the Serie B with Juventus to take them up? I don't know. He took them up. Whether he won the Serie B when they were demoted or not,
I won't class that. Any of the big leagues. But considering the squads and the clubs he's been at, he's never won it.
He won the Cup with Gaisca in that beautiful game against Atletico Madrid. And again, I don't know whether he won the second division in France with Monaco when they had to come up. But you're right. This would be his first title.
Yeah.
Would be.
And I still can't. I still can't see them. I don't know. I just can't.
Don't break my heart now. Tell you.
I want to. I think it's the most amazing story ever. Like, straight down to Hollywood and make a movie about it. But
where are the football things that you can't see him winning it? What's the...
First and foremost, quality of squad. Like, I'm just going off that. Like, surely. But, like, yeah, are we surprised? Like, Arsenal have been like that for... When did they last win it? I don't know. Over 10 years ago, was it?
We'll do an entirely new separate podcast where we'll have to give you a fee for your time, where we break down how on earth Arsene Wenger is still in charge of that club when they keep falling over. I've kind of gone off the beaten track a little bit, and we can't stop here without Fulham, because it's Roy Hodgson again. It's one of the friends I have is very, very close friends with Pep Guardiola, and he was telling him about one of the things, because he's quite a quixotic guy, Guardiola. And he keeps mentioning to my pal about one of the things he really wants to do by coming over and coaching is go to grounds that breathe the history of English football, like Craven Cottage. So he's more pissed off than Michael Jackson was that Fulham have been relegated than you are, because I was a season ticket holder at Craven Cottage for a little while when all the crowd would shout "Steed" whenever Mal Brown touched the ball or whatever. Life at Fulham. Let's talk about the stadium, for example. Do you have affection for the stadium?
I love it, yeah. It's
nuts, isn't it?
It's amazing, yeah. I remember being away team going there and you'd hate it. Like, the dressing room was half the size of this room we're in now, like, horrendous.
I.e. Not big.
Like, you're getting changed on skips and just horrendous. Mind you, the home one isn't much bigger, but, obviously, trophies, what have you, Chelsea won something at Blackburn, that's where I started, but probably coinciding with having a wife... two kids. That's probably the happiest time in my life, football in life, was probably at Fulham. First couple of years, definitely. Just incredible, amazing set of lads that you go to war with. Craven Cottage, it's such charm, I don't know. Just
that should matter to us. I think rather than just turn up, take your £200,000 a week, play quite well and sort of play in a soulless role.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is
a beautiful part of the world as well. Like, it's, yeah.
Listen, I'm going to venture out here. I don't know if it matters to you, but when I moved to Barcelona, I had to Madrid or Barcelona, and part of it was the influence of Steve Archibald. Went to Barcelona, played for Aberdeen, but I need to be near water. I actually need to be near water. And Madrid's got a little river that doesn't count. And when I was there, like living by the Thames and being near the Thames, it's just such a magnetic, hypnotic, historic, beautiful river. And it's kind of like, when you see it out of the corner of your eye, you feel like it's going to flow into the stadium.
Yeah.
It's that close to the bottom of the stand. It's epic.
Yeah, I don't think I think they were planning on building an extra 10,000 on top of the Riverside stand, but I think that'll be put by the wayside for now. Again, like Blackburn, just so sad to see them down there. But for me, they brought it on themselves. The way they ran the club for the couple of seasons before they got relegated, they're a squad of 20, and like I'm talking 10, 11, 12 loan players were coming in every Christmas, then the start of the season. So they were dicing with debt anyway. Mm-hmm. So they brought on themselves. I'd have no qualms about that.
How did you end up there? What was the actual moment when somebody said, listen, do you fancy Fulham?
Yeah, it was probably me chasing a move away from Newcastle. I scored the goal that sent them down. Like, when that went in, I was just like, my God, I can't put that more into this. And I don't know. Like, I'm a big believer, going deep, like the law of attraction, just positive.
And, I like that, yeah.
And me there, I guess I was there, what was it, 3 years? I'm like, this is awful. I need to get out of here. It's so bad. I'm not enjoying it. And eventually, I just brought it all upon myself. And I said, scored the OG, the centre now. I thought, what the hell? So I did pre-season. Chrissy Hughton was there, but I just thought to myself, you just need to get out. And
actually, in life, it's probably an unhealthy situation to be in.
Yeah, I remember knowing I was going to get a bad injury. I just knew it. I told a few people, I was like, something bad's going to happen to me. I'm like, I think any walk of life in any job, you just bring it upon you. These positive people that go out and are amazing, it's because they're positive and it comes back to them. And I ended up getting a bad injury about 2 weeks later. I was out for 10 months, dislocating my foot. I was just like, you need to sort your head out, me. And the only way in the end was just to leave Newcastle and go to Fulham. And it was me probably chasing a move. It wasn't even Roy looking for me. It was my agent, obviously, was with Roy Hodgson at Blackburn. And he says, yeah, we'd love to have Damien down here. And again, I like massive wage cut. I was obviously on a good deal at Newcastle. I think I'm more than half my wages.
Yeah.
But I just want to go play, enjoy, be happy, get married and start a family. And I just need to get away from Newcastle to do that. And the minute I met Roy, it was straightforward enough. It was, amazing coach. He's like one of my, I guess, fathers, dads in football, you call him.
Because you'd kind of principally, you'd made your career as a left winger. Occasionally people had played you maybe off a striker or... It seemed to me that Roy was quite keen sometimes playing you on the right coming in.
It kind of just all fell into place. Clint Dempsey was a right footer on the left and he scored an awful lot of goals. Like, so, to be fair, I probably would have done well to dislodge him. But I don't know, just as you get older, I've always tried to add strings to my bow. So throughout the years, probably left it too late. I wish I started, I tell the kids that now, I wish I started when I was 15, just right foot, right foot, right foot. And now I prefer kicking a ball with my right foot rather than my left, which is
the work you put in.
Yeah, and so that's probably eventually when I hit 30, I could play there. I could obviously cut in. Anyone could do that if you're left-footed, but I was happy going down the wing and crossing the ball in as well, which I possibly couldn't have done at pace 10 years ago when I was at Chelsea and Blackburn. So it just kind of all fell into place there and didn't look back. I more or less became a right-winger, which is amazing after playing 15, 20 years as a left-winger, you know?
Showed your affection for Claudio Ranieri by turning up at his place in Rome and dumping him out of Europe. Went on to... It's quite a commonplace result, actually. I saw the other day there was an Aston Villa-Everton game and something, the statistic is this is the most often repeated fixture in the history of the English First Division. And throughout my life, I'm much older than you, the most regular result I've ever heard is Fulham 4, Juventus 1. They're peppered with World Cup winners.
Yeah.
Who's the boy? Ugly one at the back. Cannavaro.
Yeah, he's not bad.
Alex Del Piero. Yeah. Fabio Grosso.
Trezeguet, I think.
Yeah. So Zaccherini is the coach.
Yeah.
League-winning Zaccherini.
Yeah.
Over to you, Damien.
Like I said, it was just a good group of lads that you'd go to war with. But yeah, even we were 3-1 down, they scored after 5 minutes. You could hear the whole Craven Cottage just deflated. So we effectively tie over. But I don't know, we just kept going. I think we scored two goals within a couple of minutes. And I think it would just galvanise any team. Like, it wasn't anything that was said at half-time or in between ourselves. We just kept going. And we were, like, I don't know how much you watched us that season, but, like, we were a slick team. Probably no world beaters or world class players, you could say, if you compare it to Juventus, but like, we were one hell of a team and we could have beaten anyone there. I think Man United came a couple of weeks later before we spanked them 3-0, played them off the park, and we did that to most people that year. Shakhtar Donetsk, like, they're the closest thing I've seen to Barcelona, and I know it's at a different level, but when we played them, they had all the boys that are Fernandinho, Villian, all them lot, and they were just incredible, but we put them out. So yeah, so there wasn't as much anything that was said from Roy, from us, and we were just a hell of a good team. I thought, anyway, maybe I'm biased, but we were a slick outfit.
All that's left is for you to say something a little bit about what it's meant to you for, you know, to be one of the boys in green, because I've been at a couple of tournaments where I followed you. I was at the 2012 tournament where you played against Spain and whatever. The World Cup excites people. The game against Spain where you're still talked about in Spanish football, which is understandable because they like people with skill. When you look back on it all, has it been a satisfying experience? Do you ever tire about talking about 2002? And what was this? Sorry, I've got a butterfly in mind now because I'm excited and I've drunk too much tea. What was the celebration in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think over in Japan and that side of the world, I guess there's an awful lot of bowing and what have you. And Robbie obviously had his cartwheel and his bow and arrow stuff going on. I was just like in the hotel and getting ready for the game. I was like, what if you score tonight? What would be? It just came to me. Said the fans were always bound to me and what have you. So came from that really. I think I was brushing my teeth. I was like, oh, I'll try that later if I score and end up, I guess, being a bit of an iconic.
They loved it, didn't they?
Celebrate, yeah. And like, I still see pictures of that now. It's outside the door there. I just saw it on the way in, yeah. There was something on social media, so I'm not on it, but the lad sent it through to me for my birthday, reminiscing, saying happy birthday, Duffer, and the 3-minute clip of me from the Spain game. And I hate listening to myself, and I actually always hated kind of watching myself play football as well, but I clicked on it this morning, and Mendieta, our good friend, was in it. He was in a couple of the clips, bouncing off me. I didn't realise I played that well, I guess.
Because you were just doing what
Yeah, like, I guess it's a blur. Like, I didn't, but I saw that clip for the first time about 6 months ago, and then obviously watched it again this morning. I can't remember the stuff I did. I was like, wow.
You've proved that you're in the Chris Waddle camp. Often if you ask a sportsman or woman about their art, they might not be able to explain it because sometimes it's innate or they've developed it without thinking about it. Maybe it's actually quite useful to develop it without thinking about it because it takes that pressure out of your head as well.
Sorry, just to interrupt. There's a winger at Rovers now and he's got a lot of ability and all, but like, I struggle coaching him because I don't know how I did it. So like you said, it's innate. I just kind of taught myself on the street. I don't know how, it just kind of happened. And now, like, when the manager asked me to go work with him for 20 minutes, I'm walking across thinking, I don't really know what to say here because I don't know how I did it. So I don't know how I did it, fuck knows how I'm going to tell him.
Well, I don't know, like, for example, I'm not doing this in any way to be embarrassing, but the fortune of my timing and some of the people who employ me have allowed me to speak at length with Messi several times. Yeah. He doesn't thrill to talk about football. He will, and he's got better over the years. Yeah. But in two of the interviews, he talked about things that I always thought about you, which is he talked about what it's like being kicked. Obviously, with rule changes over his career, it's got easier and more protected. But initially, he was kicked all the time, and he would say, like, well, if I get really done in the first 5-10 minutes, I feel after that, I'm so involved in the game, I kind of, unless something's broken, I don't feel it. I just want the ball to get back and going. Another thing that he talks about a lot is that I've asked him about what he does. I don't think he was lying, but also don't know if I got the truth. And he says he just, when he's got the ball, the patterns and the movement and the where space is just comes into his head. Yeah. It's not actively thinking about it. When you were, like, not just that game against Spain, but that's what's caused this discussion and that inability to talk to your winger at the club, at Rovers at the moment. Can you remember thinking, like, if I do this, he'll go there and that'll be a space? And you look back and saw either when I went there, maybe I wouldn't do it now. What was the type of thing that would have been in your head then? Or was it all subconscious or what?
Yeah, I found the minute I started thinking about my game, that's when I struggled. And I'm sure it's the same for most. But it just sounds cheesy. Just let it happen. Just let it flow. I don't know.
Did you see space? Or did you, like, say, if I take the ball this way, I know that there'll be somebody behind me, or I know that if I go this way, that player doesn't like going there, or if I drag him, he couldn't keep up with me last time. Does that go through your head at a million miles an hour?
Oh, like, stuff like that. Like, you mentioned Van Bronckhorst earlier, like, most people, to be fair, were probably quicker than him. So stuff like that, yeah, I'm going to run him every time because he can't catch me. I think Newman, he was the same. I remember playing him here.
Big Arthur for Holland.
Yeah. Yeah. Was he in that Barca as well? Did he not go to Barca? No, he's Ajax, was he?
He'd been...
I thought he went to Barca for a while. Maybe I'm wrong. But stuff like that, when you know you've the legs on a... Yeah, I'm going to run him every time. But I don't know, all my flicks, tricks, movements was just happened. And subconsciously, I don't know how. And that's why I say I find it hard now to relate to the kids, probably a bit.
Thank you for joining us for season 2018-19. We've got huge creative plans for the months ahead, but we do need your help to make them happen. Please go right now to patreon.com/Graham Hunter and become a socio, become a paying member, and get an extra big interview every month plus loads of bonus content. Last season, socios listened to 9 exclusive big interviews, including Rafa van der Vaart, Troy Deeney, Roberto Di Matteo, and loads of me talking about football. The Premier League, the Champions League, Spanish football. I'm sure they enjoyed it and you will too. Support us, join us. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.